KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
You're tuned in to KAEB 91.9 FM. All music, all the time.
From KMXT in Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at madsen.com/Alaska. Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game will not be opening a new commercial fishery for Magister squid in Southeast Alaska yet. That's after the State Board of Fisheries voted on the proposal at its meeting in Ketchikan. KRBD's Jack Darrell has more.
Richard Yamada proposed the idea to the board. Yamada owns a sport fishing lodge near Juneau and helps lead the International Pacific Halibut Commission. He told the board that he's spent years investigating if there's a market for the squid.
It's the most abundant squid in Alaska waters, but very underutilized.
Yamada said there's a strong global demand for Magister squid. It's a staple of restaurant menus in Japan. But the biggest exporters of the squid are China and Russia. And Yamada said that due to geopolitical factors, those markets are on a downswing.
They're having a lack of squid right now. And there's an opportune time to Alaska to get into the squid market because of the economies and the lack of high demand for a squid.
Yamada won a grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration a couple of years ago to look into making a market for Alaska's Magister squid. He said he's been testing the quality of his local squid catch on sushi chefs in Japan and Los Angeles. One of those chefs was Takeshi Suda, a sushi chef in Japan's Yamagata Prefecture. Yamada shared a letter from the chef saying that Alaska's squid's thickness, clean flavor, and consistent white color makes it good for serving raw as sashimi. Or the chef wrote, grilling or frying the tender leg meat. Magister squid are usually reddish-brown and can grow to over 2 feet long. They're native to the waters of the North Pacific, like around Japan, the Aleutian Islands, and Southeast Alaska. Yamada said they usually only live about 1 year. There used to be a pretty big Japanese trawl fishery for Magister squid in the Bering Sea in the Gulf of Alaska. Yamada said they were harvesting thousands of tons every year until the U.S. pushed the foreign fishermen out of federal waters in the late 1970s. Yamada claimed that opening up commercial squid harvests could provide another revenue stream for struggling commercial fishermen and cut down on the squid eating more prized catches like salmon and crab. Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang applauded Yamada's ingenuity, but he said without biological or catch data or any real idea of how many of these squids are in Southeast waters, the department can't really establish a sustainable management plan.
I think there's some fundamental questions. I think we can probably do something in a couple of years where we figure out that sustainability piece and also the market piece.
Board member Curtis Chamberlain also questioned the market itself, fearing a crash if China and Russia resume exports.
If you do it wrong, you can do a lot of long-term damage. There is a potential, but I really like this. So I'm a no, but we're not far away from something else.
Southeast dive fisherman Seth Rockwell spoke in support of Yamada's proposal. He said that opening up this fishery would create enough volume to start researching and gathering that data on how to manage it properly.
He's talking about a jig fishery, which is very low impact fishery, has very low chance of overharvest. And so opening up a jig fishery may expand this out just a little bit more. to allow them to get more data, to allow this to move to the next step to be a viable fishery.
Board of Fisheries Chair Margaret Carlson Van Dort says she's excited about the idea, even if she feels like it isn't quite ripe yet.
I think one of the elements that I would like to see presented perhaps in the future, because I don't know that I can support it at this time, but I'm really, really interested in this, is what the harvest need would be to sort of establish a market and production requirements and all the things.
Nearly every member of the board expressed excitement about the idea as a pleasant surprise and something they hope to hear more about during their next meeting on Southeast Alaska fisheries in 2028. The proposal failed 5-2. At the Board of Fisheries in Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Snow crabs started hitting Unalaska's docks again last month for the first time in nearly 3 years. As reported by KUCB's Maggie Nelson, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist Ethan Nichols says there are currently almost 10 vessels registered in the Bering Sea commercial fishery.
The fleet is just getting started for the most part. Fishing so far, the reports from the grounds, there seems to be good numbers of nice new shell large snow crab on the far northern portions of the grounds, similar to the last few snow crab fisheries we've had.
The fishery opened this fall after a two-year closure due to low stocks. The first delivery wasn't until mid-January. Alaska's snow crabs are historically fished in the new year and into the early spring. Nichols says, based on a handful of the first deliveries, the number of keepers per pod is somewhat low, but that should increase as the season progresses.
That's only coming from a handful of our first deliveries, and that includes, some prospecting by vessels early on in the season. It sounds like, from what we know so far, that the highest CPUEs are being seen on the northern portion of the grounds. And as vessels get more dialed in on those hot spots or those productive areas of fishing, they'll be coming in with, full loads of crab that are more reflective of the hot spots on the grounds.
Fishermen were allotted about 4.7 million pounds of snow crab this season. That's pretty low compared to historic catch limits. About 30% of that had been harvested by the end of January. Normally, some of that harvest would be processed in St. Paul, but this year everything is coming to Unalaska because Trident didn't open up their plant on the Pribilof Island, which is the only processor in the northern region. Nichols says it sounds like processing the extra crab in Unalaska is going smoothly. He says it's made some of their work at Fish and Game a little easier, too.
Just made our sampling a little bit more streamlined, really, in terms of just travel logistics this time of year. Not having to battle getting in and out of the Pribilofs with weather and flight availability and all that. It's just simplified our sampling efforts.
Nichols says he expects to see a total of about 15 vessels participate in this year's fishery. Fish ticket prices are coming in at around $3 per pound. Meanwhile, there are 10 vessels registered for the Western Bering Sea Tanner crab fishery. About 10% of that total harvest has been caught so far. Crabbers have until the end of March to catch the Tanner crabs. And the Pacific cod fishery in state waters opened up as of the end of January. Nichols says he expects about 20 vessels to kick that off. They have a harvest of roughly 44 million pounds, which is just about the same as last year's catch limit.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council, has been meeting to discuss new rules for limiting chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea pollock fishery. The Alaska Desk's and KUCB's Theo Greenlee reports that regulators have a lot to parse, including climate change impacts.
Western Alaska's chum salmon runs are in crisis, with some rivers seeing fish returns drop by more than 90% since 2020. For many Alaska Native communities, salmon is more than food. It's life. So tribal leaders and environmental groups have been urging tighter restrictions on how many salmon can be accidentally caught by pollock trawlers. But there's disagreement about whether new limits will help. Many industry representatives point to science that shows climate change is the main culprit for declining salmon populations, not bycatch. Jackie Boyer, her Chupik name is Apana Jack, is an advocate with Salmon State, an Alaska-based nonprofit that works to protect salmon habitats.
You know, climate change is an issue, but that's something that we've got no control over. But what we do have control over is bycatch.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council regulates federally managed fisheries off Alaska's coasts. It's reviewing options, like closing certain fishing areas when Western Alaska salmon are at their peak, or closing the entire fishery when the fleet collectively hits a certain bycatch threshold, a so-called hard cap.
We can't paint in broad brush strokes.
Trent Artill is the Vice President of Fisheries and Sustainability at American Seafoods, the biggest company that fishes pollock in the Bering Sea. Like many people in the pollock industry, he's asking for a more nuanced approach.
We need to craft our approach to specifically addressing minimizing Western Alaska chum salmon, taking into account those times and areas of when they occur.
For the most part, the pollock industry has strongly pushed back against any type of restrictions. But subsistence communities in Western Alaska, especially in the Yukon-Kuskokwim River Delta, say that something needs to be done. Boyer with Salmon State says the trawl fleet can't continue to self-regulate.
There needs to be some level of a cap to keep the industry in check.
The council last took up the issue at their April 2024 meeting in Anchorage, which brought hundreds of written public comments and days of testimony from Western Alaska residents pleading for the council to act.
You just hear elders, you know, crying about, you know, not having traditional food, not having traditional practices, and so many concerns about, you know, their children and grandchildren not being able to know, you know, how to live traditional ways of life.
This time around, fishing, tribal, and environmental organizations, along with private citizens, submitted nearly 250 comments in advance of the meeting. The Fishery Council might not take any action on the issue this week, but input from the public, as well as presentations from the Council Scientific Committee, will likely inform any new future rules. The pollock industry is the largest in the country and an economic driver for many Alaska coastal communities. According to federal data, the total number of chum the pollock fleet caught last year was down 94% from 2021. Fishing groups argue their voluntary changes led to that dramatic reduction. Industry boosters point to research that says more than half of the chum caught by Bering Sea pollock trawlers comes from hatcheries in Russia and Asia. And multiple federal, state, and local agencies that the council leans on for expertise back that up. The council's decision could affect not only subsistence salmon users, but also the long-term health of the multi-billion dollar pollock industry. Public testimony will begin at the council later this week. People can provide testimony at the Egan Center in Anchorage or online through the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's website. In Unalaska, I'm Theo Greenlee.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Now, the rest of the story. December 1936, the Industrial Home for Children in Woodstock, Illinois. It's midnight, and someone is singing.
Awakened by the soft, sweet melody, Oscar Allred, the manager of the children's home, rises from bed, puts on his robe. He must investigate. Which of the orphans in his charge, he wonders, is singing in the middle of the night? Well, first, Mr. Allred inspects the sleeping quarters, but passing room to room, he finds nothing but darkness, silence, because now the singing has stopped. Well, next morning, Mr. Allred calls the boys and girls together and asks who was singing last night. Well, the children regard one another with wide eyes, but no answer. No one is going to be punished, Mr. Allred assures them. He'd just like to know who and why, but still nobody answers. And the matter is forgotten, almost. Because that evening, after the lights are out, Mr. Allred is still awake in his room. If it's a prank he reasons, then surely the little culprit won't be able to resist a repeat performance. And sure enough, minutes later, Mr. Allred is once more in slippers and robe and out in the dark hallway and trying to discern the source of that sweet, small voice. Now, one place he'd not looked the night before was the basement. So quietly, Mr. Allred went down the stairs and there, as he had expected, he apprehended the mystery serenader, who turned out to be the youngest orphan at the children's home. Her name was Minnie. But Mr. Allred was wrong about this being a joke. Minnie just liked to sing in privacy, and she sang very well. Well, considering her harmless intentions and her remarkable talent, Mr. Allred could hardly be angry. In fact, right then and there, he got an idea. The following day, he made two or three phone calls to the media. It was a great story, after all, a gifted orphan singing in the dark with an untrained yet entirely beautiful voice, soothing, mellifluous, and a two-octave range. Well, the media did take notice. The week before Christmas, Minnie was prepped and primped and on her way to Chicago with her escort, of course, the tall, slender Mr. Allred. Once in the Windy City, they drove to NBC Studios. This was to be Minnie's singing debut before a live audience listening to the NBC Jamboree that evening. The success of Minnie's first encounter with a microphone was summed up in the radio section of next week's Newsweek. Quote, new star makes first appearance in Chicago studios. The guest star of the evening rose to her full height. Her throat quivered, and from it poured the golden notes of a rich coloratura soprano, and so on. Within 2 weeks of her triumphal Blue Network debut, the diminutive prima donna had her own public relations director and movie offers and recording contracts and a string of personal appearances on stage and radio. And through it all, as far as we know, Minnie never forgot her humble beginnings, nor now will you. Because little orphan Minnie discovered while singing in the cellar of the Industrial Home for Children, the vocalist who set the nation on its ear and thereafter was hailed as, quote, the phenomenon of the century. Why, she was a real live singing mouse. Only now, you know the rest of the story.
I don't know what this is all about, but it's going real slow.
A better place, and the world.
Yeah, good morning, everybody out here in Southwest Alaska. It looks like we're going to have a wind and rain out here in the Aleutians, so it appears to me that paradise is getting a little bit cranky. Start out with Alabama here with Take Me Down. After that, Willie Nelson, Angel Flying Too Close to the Sun. And then the Oak Ridge Boys with You're the One.
Tonight, take me on a one-way flight in your loving arms, and everything's gonna be all right. You're the one who took my hand, but no one else could understand. You're the one who me like nobody else can. Take me down where I want to be. Turn around this man who lives inside of me. Take me down and love me all night long. Hold me close and make me strong. Take me down. Take me down. See a light. It's your emotions glowing bright. So keep the fires burning and let it warm me through the night. You can be a part of me, 'cause you're what love was meant to be. You and me, baby, we'll set this flame inside us free. Take me down where I wanna be. Turn around this man who lives inside of me. Take me down and love me all night long. Hold me close and make me strong. Take me down. Take me down. Let's just put our hearts together, share another night in ecstasy. We know that it's feeling better every time we get together. Maybe love was meant for you and me. Whoa, take me down where I wanna be. Turn around this man who lives inside of me. Take me down and love me all night. Make me strong. Take me down. Take me down tonight. Take me down tonight. Ooh, ooh. Take me down.
you had not have fallen, then I would not have found you. Angel flying too close to the ground. And I patched up your broken wing. Hung around a while, trying to keep your spirits up. And your fever down. I knew someday that you would fly. Greatest healer to be found. So leave me if you need to. I will still remember. You're flying too close to the ground. Angel.
How many people are in this world? 8 billion? So I'm 1 in 8 billion. We all are. Linda Ronstadt's up next with the only mama that'll walk the line, then Slim Whitman with Keep It a Secret. After that, Loretta Lynn with Another Man Loved Me Last Night. Ooh.
Well, everybody knows she's been stepping on my toes, and I'm getting pretty tired. She won the head. Thank you.
and some rendezvous, painting the town with a boy she once knew. Pay no attention and just let it be, but keep it a secret from me.
Yeah, Ragmop's up next with John Lee Wills. After that, Rusty Draper with Gambler's Guitar, and then Cassandra Wilson with Time After Time, all coming down the pike right at you on KSDP Radio.
Say, Arlie, Arlie,
my guitar Tell of the hearts that this vagabond has broken Tell of the fun that I've had Tell of the loving and the laughing and the joking Back when I was glad Oh, back when I was glad Tell it pretty, my guitar Tell of the days when the riverboat was churning Oh, what a gambler's spree Tell of the haughty way old lady luck was spurning Everyone but me Yes, everyone but me Speak of the time when I took my biggest gamble The game where hearts were high Speak of the funny way my heart began to ramble When she caught my eye Yes, when she caught my eye Tell all the folks that this life's a game of poker A fool and his gold must part But in this hectic world, the biggest fool's the joker who gambles with his heart. Who gambles with his heart. Tell it sad, my guitar.
Picture
And taking us to the top of the hour, that little Hank Williams Jr., All My Rowdy Friends Are Coming. Hey, Chopper, this one's for you. Then Mary Chapin Carpenter, right back with the Bug Love. Part of this song, Chris Christopherson with Darty's Castle. Here's Hank Jr.
Oh, So let the good times roll before we say goodbye. Sometimes you're the windshield, sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes it all comes together, baby. Sometimes you're a fool in love. Sometimes you're the Louisville Slugger, baby. Sometimes you're the ball. Sometimes it all comes together, baby. Sometimes you're gonna lose it all. Sometimes you're the windshield. Sometimes you're the bug. Sometimes it all comes together, baby. Sometimes you're just a fool in love.
On the hill where the smoke is hanging still, like an echo of an age long forgotten. There's a story of a home crushed beneath those blackened stones, and the roof that fell before the beams were rotten. Cecil Darby loved his wife, and he labored all his life to provide her with material possessions. And he built for her a home of the finest wood and stone, and the building soon became his sole obsession. Oh, it took 300 days for the timbers to be raised, and the silhouette was seen for miles around. And the gables reached as high as the eagles in the sky, but it only took one night to bring it down. When Darby's castle tumbled to the ground, though they shared a common bed, there was precious little said in the moments that were set aside for sleeping. For his busy dreams were filled with the rooms he'd yet to build, and he never heard young Helen Darby weeping. Then one night he heard a sound as he laid his pencil down, and he traced it to her door and turned the handle. And the pale light of the moon through the window of the room split the shadows where two bodies lay entangled. Took 300 days.
Yeah, Dave here. I'm doing some technical work, so we'll be back on air here really quick. Right at the top of the hour, that'll be 7654 and 3 seconds in, and we'll be right back.